Lecture 34, Language Death, Prognosis.
The language death issue is not just an abstract one. There are movements around the world to revive a number of languages that are in danger of extinction. These are thriving efforts to pass these languages along to new generations. Irish Gaelic is one of the most famous of these movements, and there's another one for Irish Gaelic's fellow Celtic language, Welsh. There is another Celtic language which is spoken across the English Channel in France. That's called Breton, and there is a Breton preservation movement. And there are also language preservation movements that are particularly well known for Maori, the Polynesian language of New Zealand, and Hawaiian, which is another Polynesian language closely related to Maori, spoken in Hawaii. Some people involved in these efforts are more optimistic than others. And there is a question as to whether we can maintain all 6,000 of the world's languages. And one might want to posit that there are two extremes. One is that everybody in the world speaks nothing but English. The other is that we preserve all 6,000 of the world's languages, even though most people on Earth will continue to control one of the top 20 alongside. As so often, the truth about this probably lies somewhere in the middle in terms of realism. The chance that everybody in the world is going to speak only English is very slim. If it looks that way to us, that's partly because as American English speakers, most of us, we are not as deeply familiar with the ordinariness of bilingualism and multilingualism as many people are. English will be the top language, the H language, the high language, the public language for increasing numbers of people, but that doesn't mean that languages spoken by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people tightly tied to a culture, to a way of life, to even perhaps a worldview, are going to disappear in favor of that language. Languages exist alongside each other. So I could be a Pollyanna, but I don't think Finnish is in danger of disappearing. I don't think Koreans are going to stop speaking Korean. It seems highly unlikely, if only because of habit. Now that Koreans do speak Korean and Finns do speak Finnish, precisely what would allow them to stop it? So I don't think we have to worry too much about that. But as for maintaining all 6,000 of the languages in the world today as living, speaking, spoken varieties, I think that that is as unlikely as that English is going to truly take over the world. There are many obstacles, and they're large ones. And even if one wants to avoid being a professional pessimist, too much optimism in a case like this seems somewhat quixotic, I think. It's been said that once there's a revival movement for a language, the language is already dead. Now, that was spit in the eye. But there is some truth to the notion. For example, there's the issue of status. Often, people who speak an indigenous language that is not written don't think of it as real because it isn't written and it isn't used in wider communications. So very often, linguists and anthropologists and maybe missionaries for other purposes are more interested in preserving the language than the speakers themselves. And it's easy for us to think, oh, the poor benighted speakers who don't realize the treasure of what their language is. But we have to imagine that the language that we grew up speaking is one that we never see on the page. This is almost as difficult as laying in your bed and imagining what it really must feel like to fly. Really step out of your body. Step out of your mind and imagine that you just talk your native language. It's not written. Nobody who isn't a whole lot like you speaks it. And you just, that's your language. Then you grow up with this other one that's written and that there's Dickens in it and Sanford and Son is in it, etc. It's there. It's documented. Now, can't you imagine that you might feel that the language that you only spoke, where when you hear the word for dog in it, you don't see letters in your head, you just think of the creature, might not seem real because all it is your throat and air? I can understand that. And so, whether or not that's correct, it's a very easy impression to have. It's perhaps even defensible on an advanced philosophical level. And that means that sometimes you're telling people to preserve something that they don't really think is worthwhile. And remember, you've only got one generation. You've got 20 years. And as we all know, time passes. I found the first gray hair on my head this morning. So, then there's another problem, which is urbanization. As people move from the countryside to the city more and more, as people are chased from the countryside to the city, people are driven from hardscrabble lives in the countryside to seeking their fortune in the city. Whatever reason you come to the city, the problem is that in the city, generally there's some big fat language spoken. Now, you, out wherever you were, you spoke something interesting and exotic. But then you come to the city, and the only people you can use that language with are the people who happen to come along with you or people who happen to have gotten there before you. So there might be a club. There might be a neighborhood. You might have some friends. But you're going to have to learn that big thing. Then if you marry, the chances that the person you marry are going to speak your 1,000-speaker language are very, very small. And if she speaks something else, what you two are going to speak with each other is going to be that big fat language, probably. And then if you have kids, that's what you're going to be in. You're going to talk to them mostly in. And even if you have a relatively insular family and you actually manage to pass on not one, but two indigenous languages to these kids while you're living in a tall building and only visiting the countryside occasionally, what are the chances that the kids are going to know those two languages or even one of them well? And then what are the chances that they're going to meet someone else who speaks that language when they get married? And if they get married to somebody who speaks another one, are they going to, and so on and so on. So that means that urbanization tends to promulgate the larger languages that are used in that context over the smaller languages. And to the extent that people are moved to go to big metropolises, that spells language death for the languages that are not spoken there. There's a very intelligent work on language death called Vanishing Voices by Suzanne Romaine and Daniel Nettle. And its thesis is that we must create conditions for people to be able to stay on their land instead of going to the cities, because once you go to the city, your indigenous language is probably dead. Only keeping people on their land would do it. And of course, here you run up against the idea that you're going to tell someone, don't move to the city and try to make more money and try to see movies with big billboards, because you should stay out here in the country and speak that language that you think of as a mouthful of air that I think of as exotic because I had time to get a PhD and sit around and think about things like that. That's hard. So it's a question, and it's not a pleasant question. Then there's another problem, which is that by the time the language is dying, often, most of the people who are speaking it are no longer using the full vocabulary or the grammar anyway. So once you can say, oh dear, this language is on its way, already there's this slightly pigeonized version of it being spoken. So that means that even if you revive it, then the version of it that's being passed on is highly abbreviated. And so you have to decide, what does it mean to pass the language on if the conditions are such that you cannot pass on the language in anything like its full vibrancy? Now, of course, if the language is written, then you can go to books and find out what was decaying. But the chances that a language that has a long written tradition is going to be dying that way are slim. It happens, but usually the language that's dying wasn't written much anyway, except by outsiders who consider the language exotic, such as linguists, etc. But that's not real writing. If what you've got is a dictionary and a grammatical description and a translation of parts of the New Testament and then a couple of other things scratched on paper bags, that's not a written language. That's just a spoken language, and that's not enough to revive it. So you've got problems like that. Then there's another problem in these situations, which is discussed oddly rarely among language revivalists, but which I believe is a genuine issue. And it's not a matter of pessimism. It's not a matter of being a Cassandra. It's not a matter of having inadequate faith in people. It's a matter of hard-nosed, thoroughly compassionate, but hard-nosed reality. And that is that languages are hard. And the fact is that If you are trying to revive a language, what you're talking about is not pouring water on something and having sea monkeys appear. You're talking about teaching people how to speak a language and not read it and not be able to use it on a junior semester abroad. So we're not talking about my uncle is a lawyer, but my aunt has a spoon and all those stupid sentences that you have to learn. The idea is that you're supposed to be speaking this language a lot. And that is a hard thing to teach people, especially because we run up against something that we have learned in this series, which is that the languages that are dying tend to be small and indigenous, and those languages tend to be the hardest languages in the world. So it's very rare that we have a language dying that is as user-friendly as a Spanish. Spanish is hard enough. But not only is Spanish kind of like English, but Spanish is, you know, rather approachable in many ways. I always tell people, especially for an English speaker, if you want to learn a language and you're over about 12, go for Spanish. That's the one that will beat you up the least. Dying languages aren't like Spanish. They are not like Dutch. They're languages where they were rarely learned by outsiders, and they got very, very complicated. This includes the Celtic languages. People have not been learning Irish Gaelic as a second language until very recently. This was an in-group language. A language like Maori was an in-group language. So here we come, and we want to learn them, but these are languages that were designed to be learned by humans at a stage when they could not control their bowels, and unconscious learning. Then all of a sudden, there you are with a pad, and it's very, very, very difficult. And it's, in fact, something that you might want to devote a hobbyist attention to. And all of us are very busy. And often one senses an idea, this is a folk idea, that when you're teaching someone a language, then you're teaching them words. Oh, that it were that easy. So, darling, the word in Mohawk for aunt is this. Darling, the word in Mohawk for raise is this. But it doesn't work that way, as we've seen in this series. And as we know, if we've ever learned languages, there's grammar. We're talking about grammar as well as words. And it's grammar that's the hard part. If learning a language were a matter of taking 5,000 flashcards, laying them out on the floor in the garage, and just getting yourself to the point where you knew every word, we wouldn't have any problem. But if you're trying to help keep Mohawk alive, and there is such a movement, you've got a long way to go beyond teaching somebody the words, and the grammar is tough. And more to the point, opinions will differ as to what tough is, but we have to think about the fact that these languages are very, very, very different from English. So, for example, Mohawk is a fantastically interesting language, and there is a good, strong movement behind it to keep it from being eclipsed by larger languages such as English or French. And this is great, except when you're trying to teach somebody Mohawk, it's not just a matter of teaching them words, but it's a matter of dealing with a language where thoughts are put together in very different ways than English speakers are used to. In fact, counterintuitively different ways. So remember in Cayuga, it house bigs to her as an ordinary way of saying that she has a big house. That's weird, and that's just one of dozens of things. So, in Mohawk, let's take an English sentence like, suddenly she heard someone give a yell from across the street. Real simple. So, our sense of language, if we've learned European languages, is that it's going to be she heard, and there's going to be some verb for heard, then there's going to be a word for someone. And then give a yell, where we're going to find like some word that means yell. And then from across the street. And so we're going to have some word for street. And the part about from across is actually kind of tricky no matter what language you're going to. But we'll figure it out and we'll get a kind of a feel for it in German, the Sprachgefühl, and we'll be fine. No. In Mohawk, the way that sentence comes out, suddenly she heard someone yell from across the street, is suddenly by what you could hear, there, it's beyond the street, the ear went to who just then made shouted back towards her. Now, if you learn what the words for all those things are, you're fine. But how would you intuit that that's the way that thought would be arranged? Suddenly, by what you could hear, and so not she heard, suddenly, by what you could hear, there, it's beyond the street. You need that it. Native American languages have a real it fetish. So it's beyond the street. then you didn't hear, the ear went to, who just then kind of made a shout, yelled. And so you have to know that it's going to be make a shout. There might not even be a word yell. Make a shout back towards her. That's hard. That's really difficult. And remember that that sentence is not an idiom. So it's not as if Mohawk has this one eccentric way of saying suddenly she heard someone give a yell from across the street. That's grammar. That's normal. So how do you teach somebody that? And if you're going to teach somebody to really express themselves in that language well enough and constantly enough to pass that language on to children in the cradle, then think of all the work that it's going to take. And most of us, we have office jobs. We are helping raise other people's kids. We are watching CNN. We are taking vacations. Do we have time for this building a ship in a bottle or painting this massive dollhouse? Most people don't. So that's a problem. Another problem about learning is that context is so important when really learning a language. You can be given things by a Berlitz book or even by a good teacher. And of course, good foreign language teachers do exist despite my little pot shots throughout this series. That's good, but nothing replaces actually using the language in situations, and that can't be escaped. There's an aphorism that languages are learned best on the pillow. And we all know what that means. And what it means is that the most intimate kind of interactions that you can have with somebody day to day are the ones that will hammer a language into you the best. So, for example, Japanese is arranged in a very different way than English. And part of getting a sense of Japanese is figuring out that the word order is going to be very different. And there are certain thoughts that just tend to be put differently. It's not the nightmare from English that Mohawk would be, but it's kind of a challenge. And you can get pretty good, but then you've only gotten so far. And there are things that are easiest when you are living in it or with it or spending a lot of time with it, such as seeing a Japanese woman, as I did for a brief time a very long time ago. And they're little things. I don't know if she was ever completely clear on the fact that I didn't speak Japanese. And so she would use a lot of it rather fluently around me. So you start picking things up. And so, for example, if she wanted me to wait a bit, chotto matte, she'd say, chotto matte. Now, I could look in a book and see that chotto meant a little, and I could learn carefully how to use the verb for to wait in the imperative, matte. Okay, good. That word is chotto. Okay, good. But having somebody always handing you their purse and saying, chotto matte, or just telling you, chotto matte, cooking, chotto matte, well, you get it after a couple of times, and you realize that that means wait a bit, and you learn that chotto doesn't mean a little. You learn that chotto means a bit. It's the word that kind of gives a little hint of that sort of thing. All languages have a kind of word or expression or way of putting things. Can't learn it from a book, really. To get a sense of it, you have to see it being done. Sometimes if there was an angle of my eyebrow or a kink in my back or something strange was happening or I was watching a squirrel being caught by a cat or just some slight disturbance, she would look up at me and she'd say, ne, just ne. And I learned from about 18 nets over this brief period of time that what ne means is everything all right? You seem like there's something a little off. Is everything all right? That's not in the dictionary when you look up what the particle ne means. You can kind of get a sense, but ne, it's just the situation you needed it. Now, take the whole language and see how learning a language is about things like that. Now, here you are, and it's a revival movement, and you're supposed to be learning the Hawaiian language, and you're taking about 45 minutes of Hawaiian every 3 days, maybe every week, or even if it's every day. You're sitting in a classroom, but no matter how good the teacher is, it's not contextual. It's not real. It's a pedagogical situation. So it's an obstacle. I've done a little bit of this and seen at first hand what an obstacle this kind of thing can be. At UC Berkeley, there is every 2 years a grand summit of people who are interested in learning the Native American languages of their ancestors, languages that are now deceased, And the UC Berkeley Linguistics Department helps these people by assigning them professors or graduate students to help them learn at least the basics of their language and to show them the sources that they need to do it. And it's a wonderful idea for people to recover the language of their ancestors. And people vary in terms of how well they really want or expect to speak the language. But I dealt with people who were descendants of speakers of Northern Pomo, which is one of the great many fascinating Native American languages of California. And my job was to give them as much Northern Pomo as I could within the period of time of the workshop. Now, this was not like teaching people Spanish. These were people who had grown up all their lives in English. In terms of demeanor and affect and dress style and other cues, these people would strike most of us as Americans. There was nothing exotic about them. And so, they wanted to learn Northern Pomo. It was as if we wanted to learn Northern Pomo. Wasn't a matter of teaching them some cute conjugations, I, you, he, she, and all of that. It was a matter of teaching some very different things. So first of all, Northern Pomo it's gone now, SOV. That is subject, object, verb. The verb comes at the end. Now, I've carefully explained that to us, and we are all presumably kind of language heads, as I call them, people who are interested in language. These were people who worked in offices. They had lives, and here the first thing I have to explain is when you're trying to say something, the verb has to come at the end. Well, for one thing, most of these people hadn't had to think about what a verb was for decades, and so it's not as immediate to them as it might be, certainly not to a linguist and maybe not to a language head. Then you have to remember to put it at the end. Then you have to remember what the object is. Now, I know to a linguist, to me, verbs and objects is like turning the sink on in the bathroom. But to other people, it's not. It's kind of like remembering what protons and neutrons are. So that's the first thing. Then Northern Pomo was full of sounds that kind of hard to make. Luckily, it wasn't a tsez, it wasn't a click language, but there were some weird sounds. So it's not a matter of Spanish with its ls and its ns and things like that and mastering an accent that we associate with good food and people who we know and like. It's weird sounds that they've never had to make before, and of course, there's no native to imitate. My rendition of this from the page, I imagine, was kind of cute, but that had nothing to do with the actual language. They're tape recordings of people telling tales in the language, but how do you imitate that? That's not a living person. The tape is never going to look you up in the eye and say, "Nah, that's not going to happen." So, it was difficult. The way the grammar of Northern Pomo works is just completely off the wall compared to English. And here we had this limited amount of time. And to be perfectly honest, I was very happy to teach them numbers. I was very happy to teach them a few set phrases. But it was quite clear to me that the chance of these wonderful people to learn anything of Northern Pomo beyond the very fragmentary was nil. And I don't think that the situation that I saw was extraordinary. The language is too different. It's too hard. It's too hard to learn a language. It's too late. It's gone. So, a lot of revivalists look at Hebrew for inspiration. And this is a language that definitely did come up from the ground and become the language of Israel today. Millions of people speak it. It is spoken from the cradle by Israeli babies. It was risen from being a liturgical language to a spoken one. But Israel was a very unique circumstance. It was a new land entirely. Immigrants speaking several languages came to that land and needed a language in common anyway, and so that was important. This was a language that had been richly preserved in writing, odd for a language that's being brought up from the ground, and this was a people who had a tradition of a particular relationship with the printed page, which is not true of most peoples on earth. Writing is an artifice. And then, in addition, the use of Hebrew was associated with a very powerful and discrete religious impulse, the idea being that this rooted you in the cosmos to speak this language. Those conditions are not coming together in any of these other language revival situations. The reasons that people want to revive the languages are quite laudable, but the reasons are not ones that are going to hit one in the gut and create an almost obsessive desire to use a language you didn't grow up with that there was in early modern Israel. So I'm not sure about these language revival movements. I certainly wish they could work, but I'm not sure that they're going to work beyond there are always a certain number of families who are using the language more than others and even passing the language in some form onto their kids. There are clubs. There are fans. And in the Irish situation, there are radio stations. All of these languages are used in the schools to a certain extent. But even that isn't enough to pass the language on meaningfully down generations. But in terms of room for hope, I think that we might want to start thinking about a difference between spoken languages and taught languages. It seems to me that as time goes on, many more languages than we're used to are going to survive, but as second languages rather than first ones. And so it's more common than we Westerners often know for a person to speak a language or two that they learned after being a teenager or even rather late in life for mundane reasons of work or trade. They don't speak the whole language, but they've certainly got enough. It seems to me that with Irish and Welsh and Breton and Maori and Hawaiian, those languages are going to be passed on to the point that many, but not all people, have a kind of a proficiency in them, which they use to some extent, just like for most of us, French and Spanish occupy that place. Most of us don't claim to speak perfect French or Spanish, but we had it in school. Some of us kept it up. Some of us didn't. All of us can, most of us can speak a bit of at least one of those two languages, probably a bit more than a bit. Probably can get most of a newspaper article. That's typical, probably, of most people who bought this set. That's what those languages that are being revived are probably going to be like. Irish Gaelic is not going to vanish from Ireland, but the idea of most, or I think even a significant portion of Ireland's population running around speaking Irish Gaelic in a fluent way seems to me to be rather remote. And I say that not because I wouldn't like there to be a living Irish Gaelic, because I can't quite see mechanically how that could realistically happen based on the realities that I've talked about in this lecture. And then there are a great many languages, I would say most of them, that are only going to survive on paper. There are small languages where the polity that they are contained within, and there are many countries with dozens of languages spoken within the borders, these languages cannot be given pride of place over others, and having all of the languages within the education system would be impractical. And so it seems that with many of these smaller languages, our job, if we're interested in the diversity that languages have developed into, is to document them. And so that is a lot of what linguists do these days. Linguistics is not about policing people for blackboard grammar, as you saw from one lecture in particular. And linguistics is not about translation. Linguistics is about all sorts of things. But one of them is about just documenting how some of these minority languages work. The ideal is to go into a community like this and to compile a dictionary and to write a grammatical description and ideally also record some texts such as folk tales and things like that to have running samples of the language. And that's what people like to do in order to preserve these languages, with the assumption often being that the language itself is going to disappear. So ideally, it would be nice if we had good descriptions of as many, say, Native American languages and Australian Aboriginal languages as possible. When we hear about the deforestation of the Amazon is also home to a bewildering splotch of very interesting languages. When one of those little groups, generally preliterate in their language, is chased out of the forest and they go to a Brazilian city and start dealing with Portuguese, their children are going to be brought up watching Portuguese on TV and being taught in it. And so goodbye to the Tuyucas of the world with all of the evidential markers. So it would be nice to have descriptions at least of all of those languages, because, for example, it was in obscure languages of South America that we actually discovered that there was a such thing as a language with object, verb, subject, order. Only there. It was interesting to find it. It had implications for linguistic theory. So even if the language itself does not survive forever, it'd be nice to know how it worked while it was around. So I'll close this lecture by saying that although I completely understand why a person may still feel that letting these languages go is not as important as, for example, helping to eradicate poverty and other very urgent issues, that if one feels that it would be nice to preserve at least some of these languages, then if you've got some spare time, and if you happen to have a slight obsession with languages, you might want to contact your nearest linguistics department and see how you could be of assistance.